Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing the impact of the US-Israel-Iran war on Africa. I'm joined by a very special guest, Confidence McHarry. Confidence is Senior Associate Analyst at SB Morgan Intelligence based in Lagos, Nigeria. Confidence, it's a pleasure to have you join me today and I look forward to our conversation.
Absolutely. It's nice being here. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. So let's start off. So there is an ongoing war between the United States in collaboration with the Israel against Iran. And this is turning into kind of like a global kind of war because of the impact of this war on oil, on economy, on everything. How is Africa impacted?
I think the most visible has been the economic impact in the sense that Africa is a repository for energy when it comes to crude oil, and it is therefore naturally expected that there should be some sort of a windfall for a lot of oil-producing states. But we are not seeing that in places, Nigeria being one of them, because a lot of Nigeria's oil has been hedged, in attaining loans for its development. And so the kind of windfall you come to expect for these countries to gain since the Strait of Hormuz was blocked, the Gulf countries are in literal trouble. And, you know, we are not really getting oil is currently hovering around $90 to $100 per barrel. And only a handful of countries are benefiting from there because many of these other African countries have mismanaged their oil wealth and some of the revenues that should accrue from the way they used to accrue some 50 years ago during the Yom Kippur War. So I think in the most visible sense, the economic consequences have been the most felt. Politically, not many people are that much aligned with Iran on many diplomatic issues because of how naturally suspicious of Tehran many African governments are. And so the political fallout and the blowback has not really been as intense as the economic consequences, where you're seeing a lot of fuel queues, energy queues, and the likes as energy prices have simply gone up.
Let's stay on the economic impact, and that is also felt all around the world, not just in Africa. Well, you mentioned something. You said Africa is the repository for crude oil. So I'm guessing what that means is Africa exports its crude and then imports its the refined oil. But in Nigeria, we've seen recently, I think with the Dangote refinery, where there's been some sort of shift in local production or local refinery. How is Africa responding in that sense? Or
I wouldn't say it is very instructive to note that Dangote refinery is the biggest in Africa, and its processing capacity is not equal in size as what you get to see in many Asian countries, China, India, and the likes beyond. These are not oil producing countries, but the refining capacity is bigger than what Dangote actually has. And tells you a story of the value chain, how Africa is just to wake up in the over. Yes, of course, a few countries might have, I will come to the nearly see that taking cocoa out and then trying to get chocolate back when you're taking the raw products to the world is, it's not really the best way to get value for your money, and that they've tried to make the cocoa. Yeah, we've also seen the same thing when it comes to the processing of natural resources like lithium, cobalt, and the rest. But some of the structures remain. And it's of, as novel as the idea is, the ability to do that of Italy as Africans have not really been felt in terms of the in terms of government involvement, investments, infrastructure in making sure that beyond just the diplomatic pulling, trying to gather together to demand fairer prices for finished products and the likes, making the investments arena conducive enough for people who want to invest in the value chain and supply chain in this part of the world actually does. I think one or two countries may have cracked it in terms of trying to make sure that from the beginning to the end, that is from the natural resources to the finished products, everything is being done in their countries. But the vast majority of the continent are yet to wake up to their fact. And it's not necessarily, yes, some people might adduce it to a global conspiracy theory doing all of that. But let's be honest, the infrastructure is simply not there for you to do that all the time if you actually want to.
I do agree with you, because that's going to be the next question I was going to ask. Because we've seen in the past where we've kind of wondered why a continent with so much abundant resources would then be impoverished in a way where you talk about the value chain, when Africa is just for extraction of raw material rather than the finished product. But again, the question, you mentioned a number of things, and I wanted to pick you up on that. Is it an issue of political will, or is it an issue of capacity? In terms of, like, you mentioned environment, but if you talk about environment, the government is supposed to provide that enabling environment. So is it more of political will, lack of political will, or lack of capacity?
I think it could be both, but I cannot really speak to the political will aspect. But I'll just sort of focus mostly on the capacity. So for instance, that, I mean, before we joined this call, we were complaining about infrastructural issues, about electricity and my ability to stay on the call for 30 minutes. You know, so in 2026, these structural issues remain. I think at SBM Intelligence some years ago, we talked to for the reports we did in 2021, it's titled Nigerians Just Want to Eat. And we talked to a couple of farmers across some states in the country, what their biggest concerns were. And it wasn't insecurity, wasn't even top of the list for them. For some of them, access to roads, good roads, and good roads also entail better roads and less extortion on the roads. And also importantly, storage issues. You know, and if you look at storage issues as a standalone, you could adduce it to the poor energy, poor power supply. You know, so The infrastructure for power. Really being that graded enough for you to have storage industries or people who will be investing in storage to come in to want to make a difference in that space. So when it comes to capacity, everything goes back to how government's infrastructure is structured. So the infrastructure is simply not there. So in terms of capacity, the question then becomes, are these governments, are they able to, or are they willing you know, to invest in the capacity? If they wanted to invest in that capacity, do they have the means to invest in that capacity? And I think by the time you begin to unpack the differences between both, you begin to get some of the answers you're looking for to see that at least the situation is not as straightforward as it seems.
I'll go back, I'll tax you a bit on the political side, but let me stay a bit on the economic side. So if you look at different countries in Africa, about 54 countries and 4 regions, and I know these countries have different kind of like realities or way they ameliorate the situation. Would you say this crisis have had an even impact, or is there more regions or countries that are more vulnerable to this crisis?
I haven't really taken stock, to be honest with you. I haven't really taken stock on on the individuality of the African countries that are most affected by the conflict, because I've mostly been focused on the global impacts in terms of the Asian markets, and now it's going to affect the supply chains. Supply chain shocks are now is going to affect these other countries. But in terms of something that in terms of the places where the Africans have been benefiting, I think a Bloomberg projection said that a couple of countries, maybe like I think Angola being one of them, Nigeria being another, were supposed to benefit from oil windfalls and the likes. But away from the oil, and if you look at other things associated issues with the war in Iran, where you have shut down the Strait of Hormuz, of course, 20% of the oil passes through there. But oil is not the only thing that passes through the Strait of Hormuz. Fertilizer also passes through the Strait of Hormuz. And I think the most widely used fertilizer in this part of the world is urea. For a country like Sudan, you get a significant amount of its fertilizer from the Middle East, and Sudan is currently at war. The civil war is likely going to be exacerbated by lack of access to fertilizer. There are also some other countries that are also likely affected by this. Ethiopia would also likely to be affected. If you look at it from a broad-based food security angle, some of the worst African countries to be affected are some of the world's most war-torn African countries, especially those zones which sea imports largely depend on the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf of Aden. I have mentioned a few, Ethiopia, Sudan, several of them.
Well, I'll come back to the economy. Let me go to the politics for a minute. So we've seen that in this war, even the US allies, the Western allies, are not that aligned with the US and Israel in this. You've mentioned the Straits of Hormuz for a number of times now, and we've seen where the Trump-led administration has called for allies to send ships to make sure the Strait of Hormuz is open for stuff. Now, but I've also heard, I don't know how true this is, that Ghana, I think it was Ghana, maybe Ghana's military or Ghana's air base or whatever it is, and Africa as well, there have been some military air bases in Africa as well that the US can Africa be drawn into the war through this in this manner? Because I've heard rumors about go on. No, go on, please.
Yeah, at the moment it is a little bit far-fetched. Yeah, I'm saying that at the moment it's a little bit far-fetched. The military bases the Americans have in Ghana, and now the talks they are getting into with the Malians, trying to reestablish an intelligence and reconnaissance station, is not necessarily to support its Middle Eastern. It has its own basis. I think even if you want to have an African country that may be involved in the war in the Gulf, that would be Djibouti, where you have Camp Limonier, American naval base that is stationed there. So it could be called upon to support its operations, maybe against the Houthis, if they decide to get in on the action. But the Houthis haven't decided to get in on the action for whatever reason. So I do not think that if you have in West Africa American military bases that they could be drawn into the war. When we come to ballistic missiles, I don't think at the moment Iran possesses intercontinental ballistic missiles, even though, yes, the Americans and the Israelis have gone to great lengths to degrade Iran's ballistic missile capability, but I do not think that Iran has such ballistic missiles, so much so that if in the event that America decides to use its bases in, say, in Ghana to shore up its operations in the Middle East, Ghana becomes automatically a target. I really do not see that happening.
But another thing again that might happen, that I don't know if you've seen threat analysis of this, where with the way Iran, obviously, when we talk about this missile, talk about this weaponry, we've seen modern warfare where the weak can fight in a different way. And Iran is having fight an effective economic warfare, not necessarily, but it's been attacking US allies in the Middle East. So could it be a question? Because over the years, the one thing that we've heard is America has been a base in Nigeria. So looking at the way Iran is fighting, should Africans that are allowing Western nations to have military bases in them, should they fear that they could be caught up in a geopolitical war where the other people can feel like, you know, you're just fair game because you're providing some sort of support to our enemy, which is the kind of way Iran is fighting?
Perhaps in the future, we might see the U.S.-Africa Command become embroiled in such kind of thing. I remember when the U.S.-Africa Command was going to be set up in its headquarters in Africa. Then we had the Arajua as president. They had the Ethiopian guy. I'm trying to remember if it is Mengistu Hail Mariam, and we had a couple of staunch Pan-Africanists who, we are opposed to the idea. Nigeria was one of the people, I think, under the Arajo administration had opposed it, having the U.S. Africa Command put its headquarters on African soil. But many other African countries choose to have American presence. Niger, one of our closest neighbors, choose to have those an American base. So the shush simply went on. But I don't think there is any country in Africa, at least for the foreseeable future, that goes into a problem of conflict with the U.S. and with the capacity of Iran for so much so that it begins to threaten its neighbors directly with military action. I think the worst we are going to see is what is happening between Sudan and its neighbors, especially Chad, where, you know, support for one particular country will, you know, automatically mean that sometimes at some point we might begin to see border clashes between them and a lot of refugees moving in between borders overwhelm the other country. The war in Sudan is very complicated. Chad had paid both sides, to its maximum benefits. Today, it is either reaping the benefits or suffering the consequences of both. So I think that should be a proper time. But given the matchup between African states and Iran, you know, in the capacity to take on Israel and the United States, I don't really think that is something that for now we should be losing sleep over. In possible future scenarios of how this thing is going to play out.
But what we've seen in recent times, we've seen Africa becoming a playground for the kind of what people have called a new scramble for Africa, where we're seeing like some sort of new world order to be created. So we've seen in this war, you mentioned Sudan. So we've seen where international actors in Iran, Russia, even Ukraine, Turkey, the United States, people are taking sides against the RSF and the SAF. And we've seen where, even in the Sahel, we've seen Iran influence, we've seen Russian influence, and we've seen people just kind of like aligning and non-alignment. We've seen recently some Africans fighting in the Russian-Ukraine war. So, looking at all of this, do we see, maybe now or in the medium term, on the long term, do we see Africa being, again, I know I've asked this question, but I'm asking it in the light of all the Russia-Ukraine war and what we're seeing. Do you see Africa being caught up in all of this?
Yes, of course, we might be caught up in all of this in the sense that for some of the resources that power violent conflict, interstate conflict, in 2026, it has moved beyond sticks and stones like we used to see in the Stone Age. We are now dealing with high tech. Some of the conflicts between some of the war fighting between Israel and Russia and Ukraine. Nowadays, it's hardly between hand-to-hand combat between infantry troops. It has become a lot more technological. And so there will be the craze to have technological superiority when it comes to military affairs. Africa, like I said previously, is a repository of some of the best best-known natural resources to that effect. Lithium, cobalt, you name it, you know, Nigeria is a country that has monazite in large quantities and been found in Plateau State that has been shipped to China without even us realizing exactly how important for military weapons development manners it is. So a lot of these countries will be really, really interested in Africa. Maybe if you look at the fighting between major powers, it may or may not be limited to the Mediterranean, the northeastern, the northern part of Africa. But when it comes to the supply side, in terms of the value chain for how these natural resources would be sourced, at least I think the American involvement in the conflict between the Congo DR, that's the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Rwanda, and the hasty peace deal that was put together is a testament, is a prototype of how such deals in the future might be done. And sometimes, even in the desperation for such minerals, those deals will not be done, and the minerals will be straight up processed. I mean, the Chinese have laid that blueprint and everything. So when it comes to war, when it comes to conflict, I think everybody that sources of would be a big player, in the sense that they will control supply chains, they will control resources and the likes. But in terms of being actively involved in the violence, I think it's a different question automatically. But for both sides, you know, for multiple sides trying to gain advantage over the other in terms of building military superiority through technological edge, I think Africa stands to gain, especially if they play their cards wisely.
Let me come back. Thank God you mentioned DRC. Let me come back again to a bit of the economy. So in DRC, a place that is blessed with enormous resources, but unfortunately, you know, bedeviled with conflict, we see that the Chinese have a massive control of resources in there, and we've kind of seen like some sort of battle for supremacy or control between the Chinese and the US. So I would say overall, what we're seeing is like we've seen some economic kind of warfare going on. Before even ongoing on with the US and Donald Trump stuff, with the tariffs being slapped on many countries, including many African countries. And you mentioned DRC, you mentioned, and there's also, you mentioned Mali, you mentioned the transactional relationship between the Trump administration for these resources. So I guess my question is this, far beyond the Iran, Ukraine, which we've seen that is more also an economic war, regardless, it's not necessarily ideological, it's just an economic war. If we see all of that coming on, we see in Africa, you mentioned in the Straits of Hormuz, but we have other assets in Africa, Gulf of Aden, you mentioned, Gulf of Guinea, different kind of outlets that can be opened. What is Africa, how is Africa building its own capacity, its own independent capacity, whether be it its naval capacity, to be able to ward off, let's say there's a threat coming to Africa as a whole, or to be able to protect its own resources?
I don't think this is something that Africans have actually woken up to. So to answer your question in a nutshell, the answer is no. It's not something they're thinking about. And the reason it's not something they're thinking about is, if you categorize African countries according to their own foreign relations. So you have on one hand a set of people who are much more interested in making their country basis for international naval powers. So Djibouti, for instance, is practically a landlord for any middle power or great power who wants to base, you know, in the Gulf of Aden and in the Mediterranean. And then you have this Somaliland trying to do the same thing for them to gain sovereignty. And the Somalians are saying, no, you don't have to do this with Somaliland. Come to us. We can't give you the permission to do that. And you have on our part of the African shore, you have Equatorial Guinea doing the same thing for China, and then which is pissing the Americans off. So those people are looking at setting up military bases on their soil for quick development. But in terms of protection of naval, for projection of naval power and everything, I think one region that has actually seen the need for protection of its naval integrity or its territorial integrity using the Navy is West Africa, in the Gulf of Guinea, where piracy had been a problem for quite some time. I think at some point, the International Maritime Bureau listed the Gulf of Guinea as the world's most pirated hotspot. And it took a consortium of international partners, the Danes, the Americans, for to put the problem at bay. So in the entire region of West Africa, the Nigerian Navy is the most capable. So I was looking at the data the other day, and some countries as big as Ivory Coast only has about 8 patrol boats. So the naval capabilities to do that is not something that many African countries south of the Sahara has taken really into account. Given the historical volatility in and around the Mediterranean, is something you expect the Northern Africans to take stock of. So it's consistently, whenever there is a ranking from global firepower about the military capability of African states, you tend to consistently see Algeria and Egypt rank among the top three, because they know the environment, and they know the kind of threats that they face, so they always rank higher in terms of ability to keep their own water safe and the likes. But for Africans south of the Sahara, I don't think that the threats have been that maximized enough for you to have the kind of naval capabilities you come to expect countries in the Gulf to have.
So if we look at it, like you mentioned, these different dynamics in these different regions and countries, should Africa have a lab? I'm looking at the AU. What's the capability of the AU or even the region? Should Africa have a concerted, should it be thinking in a concerted way, response, or should it be regional or even individual countries?
Concerted response to what?
Yeah, I mean, like for instance, in terms of like not necessarily preempting, but providing some kind of like maybe be it shock to the conflict, or to prevent the impact of this conflict, or preventing it in the future. Should Africa be having a concerted collective approach to it, or is there any existing approach with the AU?
Is this in regards to the conflict in the Gulf?
Yeah, I'm talking the conflict in the Gulf and how its impact. Yeah, I see your laugh here. Like, you see, you're still dealing with bread and butter issues.
What we take concern, Agbero would overload. I mean, it's important since we. Yeah, when it comes to the war between Israel and Iran, it's a continent dividing issue, given that the continent is almost evenly split between. Sorry, I'm talking about the conflict between Israel and Gaza. You tend to have countries with relations with Israel, and so when it comes to the United Nations, when it comes to voting to either condemn Israel or to condemn terrorism in the Gaza Strip, there's a tendency for a particular set of Africans to vote in one way, and then a particular set of African countries like Nigeria, that is almost evenly split across religious lines, to vote in a certain way. And so in that particular regard, it is one of those things that is not get to expect the African Union to put a unified statement, because not all foreign policies on the continent is the same. I mean, let's say hypothetically, for instance, now, or not even hypothetically, you currently have an active war going on between Israel and Iran. And then you have a Kenya that is an Eastern African powerhouse, very evidently aligned with the US, very pro-Israel. I do not think that the Kenyans are going to allow such a statement to be put out and say the entirety of Africa condemn Israel in that regard. And then you also have some other countries in the region that may or may not be sympathetic to the cause of Iran. And it's just going to be very something that is very divisive. So as you said, the AU is an organization that even in the most important bread and butter issues that affect the average African, they are almost not anywhere to be found, let alone something that happens for even Gulf. Yes, one could make the argument that, I mean, the Gulf of Aden, the Strait of Hormuz, is very close to where you have your this thing, your North African members of the African Union, but I think they believe this is a problem that the Arab League would have to deal with, not necessarily the African Union.
So let's leave this. We're going to be wrapping up soon, but let's leave this government and talk about the people. So Africa has a massive youth population, and we've seen tensions across the continent. In Kenya, you mentioned Kenya, we saw the public finance bill. In Nigeria, we saw the end of bad governance. We saw the NSAS protests. In Madagascar, we've seen, in all these places, we've seen a clash between the young generations that are far removed but are clear to global issues. So we might be talking about the AU or the older, the leaders How about the citizens themselves? So do you think there's going to be, how are the citizens reacting to these global issues that are impacting their day-to-day life? Because you're talking about the queues in the pump, it's the people that are reacting to it. So how do you think these issues are they going to push that government to act well, or are they what do you think is going to happen with all this?
Naturally should push the government to be a lot more responsive and to be a lot more responsible to the needs of the average African. Because if you live in Nigeria at the moment, it's the energy crisis, it's a huge talking point. I mean, Abuja at the moment, I came in yesterday and everywhere seems very dry. I've talked to some residents and I said, yes, Abuja is not as noisy as Lagos. And I said, yes, but it's Salah. Everywhere should be popping. I should be hearing music. I should be seeing children in clothes. I mean, fine clothes and everything. They said, have you seen the price of fuel and all of that? So the direct effect of what's happening in the Gulf is having deleterious impacts down here. So I think for a responsible government, they will look at this thing and then try to have a lot more energy security, especially when it comes to power for their own people. We've had very different and numerous iterations of the Gulf crisis, at least even since before my own parents were born, with the Six-Day War, even before preceding the Six-Day War in 1967, we had the Arab-Israeli conflict that led to the establishment of the Israeli state in 1948. After that, we had the Yom Kippur War in 1973. We had the Israel-Lebanon crisis in the 1980s. We've had the first and second Intifada. We had the 50-day war. We had the 12-day. We had different wars and everything with interesting impacts, you know, in terms of energy security for Africa. And these lessons have not been learned. It doesn't fill me with that much optimism that for many of these other countries in Africa, they will learn to take energy security a lot more seriously, especially given how close they are to the. It is something that beyond looking at their own places, at their own coast being an alternative, maybe the Cape of Good Hope in Southern Africa as an alternative to the Gulf in the Middle East for shipping fees and the likes, or for passage fees, or looking at West Africa as a different place for many of these people to pass, it should be a very good opportunity for you to say, given some of the structural issues that are happening in the Middle East, we need to have our own energy security, even away from oil. I was saying that we have to start looking for alternative sources for energy. We have some people will tell you that Nigeria is a gas country that is swimming in bits of oil. Our gas ability is not developed, and it would be a great thing for our LNG industry to be invested in, or for it to be a credible alternative to fuel. Yeah. And then there are also issues with nuclear energy, which many African countries are not even looking at. And if it's nuclear energy is something that you want to dabble into, the army, there are lots of people that are willing to help. We have great relationships with the Russians.
Let me ask you the last question. So we've in my experience, in my research history and everything, and in the recent times, there's been that understanding that nobody's coming to save Africa. You know, Africa needs to take its destiny in its hand. Whether, you know, the way you and I know it, the way you said it, whether you claim ignorance or not, whether Africa is being ripped off, but then again, there's a mass of people, young people that are growing, that are not happy with the way things are going on, and sooner or later, African leaders have to do stuff. So I guess my question is this: what do you see moving forward in the short, medium, and long term with this conflict going on? And I think this conflict is also like a shadow conflict for the bigger conflict, which is an economic conflict between US and China, and eventually Africa will have to take a side. So how do you see this going on? How should Africa position itself? What actors or stakeholders in Africa? Is it the leaders? Is it the people? What can you project to conclude?
I will say that we other countries have played both sides successfully whenever you had crisis. I don't think there's a reason why Africa should not do the same. You know, so we should be getting the best maximum value. Congo and Rwanda has given us a blueprint in the sense that the Chinese have been there, and then the American side to step in, and then they said, okay, no wahala, we are going to allow you to step in, but we're also going to be getting as much value. But the problem is that many of the value these African countries elites are for the ruling elites. They're not necessarily for the people. And some of these other people who come in, especially from China, they know this. We do not have an American administration that cares about human rights and development for the global South as we used to. And as a result, we have a very transactional presence in the White House. So it's an opportunity for Africans to look at this and say, okay, we are going to attract as much investment, we are going to attract as much concession from the two global superpowers as possible and use it for our own development. When the Chinese came with the Belt and Road Initiative, it led to massive development of ports in infrastructure, you know, improved the lives of some people using, giving them bridges and the likes. I think that model is great enough. What and all, even though it has its own problems, like some Westerners will tell you, being dead child diplomacy and all of that. But I think in a conflict between East and West, especially between Russia, China, and the United States, it behoves African leaders to look at both sides and look at not only where their bread is buttered, but how to get the maximum concessions from both sides. And it will involve putting their houses in order. Nigeria is a very good case where you have mining that is causing problems. I mean, illegal mining that is fueling insecurity. If it's able to get its illegal mining crisis in order, at least to regulate the industry well enough that any player that is coming, it is getting not only development, but also the kind of revenue from the industry players that will be channeled into development of their countries. But sadly, I do not really think that the African leaders see beyond their noses when it comes to this, beyond the immediate gratification they will get from kickbacks.
Confidence. We're happy that the internet kind of helped for us for this people. Well, thank you very much for your time, and sorry once again for the confusion in terms of the format in which the podcast was. But I really enjoyed our conversation, and we can always be optimistic and hope, you know, that African leaders can wake up to what they need to do. But I also stand on the ground that these things have to be internally driven, and the influences have to come. So, but thank you very much for your time, and we're really grateful, and I wish you the best.
Thank you. Thank you also for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you for tuning in today for another episode with our guest, Confidence Makari, in discussing the impact of the ongoing Israel-US-Iran war on Africa. Join me as usual to thank our guest, and for now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next time.